Prime Minister Lee, welcome to Saturday Extra. Thank you for giving us your time.
Happy to have you here.
Does this neighbourhood of ours, because Singapore and Australia share it, does it frighten you more these days? It's pretty volatile.
Well, it's always an exciting place to be. Never a dull moment.
Character building, as we say.
We have been living in this place for a very long time.
You told our parliament in your visit last year to Australia that both Singapore and Australia faced similar dilemmas, that China was our major trading partner, but that we traditionally had our major alliance on which our national security depended upon the United States. And the United States, of course, is a little bit more unpredictable these days. So are you and Singapore changing your mind at all about these relationships?
We maintain good relations with many countries. You are an ally of the US, we are a partner of the US, not an ally. We are both major trading partners of China, major to us. And we have to keep our relationships up to date, at the same time maintaining a certain rationality and consistency and predictability in our positions, because our interests don't change so suddenly, and the enduring interests are security, stability, cooperation, integration in the region, and peace and prosperity mutually in the Asia Pacific. And I think Mr. Turnbull would agree with this, that the U.S. continues to have a major role to play, that the U.S. continues to see itself as fully engaged in the region. The new administration is setting a new direction, really still defining a new direction for itself. And we should work with it and hope that they will be able to work something out which will be in the long-term interests of the U.S. and of the region, which will mean it's good for Singapore and I think it'll be good for Australia.
There's some sort of shift on, though, is there not, with obviously the big power of China coming in whatever form remains to be seen, I suppose, and the US. Now, does that worry you? Because that's historically not an easy time.
That's not because of the US election. I mean, China has been developing, growing in economic strength and its influence in the region, and that will continue. We are happy to see China prospering. We're happy to see China playing a constructive, positive role in the region. We hope that this will be within an international framework where all countries can prosper, big and small, in a rules-based international order. And if that is the case, then I think it will be welcomed and it will be positive. But it's quite hard to do, because when you have a major shift in the strategic balance like this, it's easy to have anxieties and nervousness and pushback. And I think that's something which China has to be conscious of and is conscious of.
The Belt and Road Initiative has captured a lot of attention in Australia, and there is an interesting opinion emerging. It's only subtle now, but some of the seasoned commentators like Paul Kelly from The Australian wrote just recently, having been there for the big announcements, that the rest of Asia is not necessarily as worried about the rise of Big China as Australia has assumed they are. Australia is fooling itself, he wrote recently, in constant claims that Southeast Asian nations are desperate for a strong US military presence to balance China. They know, the region has lived with China for centuries and knows that when China is wealthy, then the region will benefit and the wealth will spread.
Well, I think many countries, including Singapore, see the Belt and Road as positive. China's influence is growing. It's natural that they want to exercise, well, they want to integrate more, do more business with countries around them. And the Belt and Road is a constructive way in which they can do so. And there are many opportunities for their countries, from Chinese investments, from trade with China, from projects to be done, from financing. And that's why Singapore supports the Belt and Road, and we support the AIIB. So does Australia. You've
yes,
joined the AIIB
eventually.
Too, eventually, after a debate. But I think at the same time, many countries in the region have deep ties with other major economies in the world, with the United States, with the European Union, with Japan, and they would like these to continue because there's markets, there's technology, there are education links, there are people ties, and it's part of an open globalized world that all parts of the world are linked to one another. You are not carved off as one sphere of influence. And I think that is important to the countries in the region. And I think the security factor remains. We talked about it just now. But the U.S. plays an important role in the security of the region, will continue to do so. And that is something which many countries benefit from and support in their own varying ways.
Well, you know, you've now got, as we heard this week, that India and Japan are in effect setting up their own partnership, a separate partnership, which is a bit of a surprise, really. There are breakout issues, aren't there, in this new world?
Well, I think we're all adjusting to a gradually shifting strategic environment. And India is also growing. It's still not as vibrant or as big as China is as an economy, but it has tremendous potential because its population is younger. And with Mr. Modi, he's quite determined to make India even more prosperous than it is now. And I think that that will mean that it will want to increase its influence in the region, which I think isn't for the good.
Do you? So all of these breakouts, you don't find them
Well, we were very supportive of the East Asia Summit, which Australia belongs to. And the point of the East Asia Summit is that it's not just Southeast Asia and China and Japan and Korea and Northeast Asia, but it also brings in India and it also brings in Australia and New Zealand. And we think that that more inclusive grouping is a right way to do things, because the chance of your becoming a bloc by yourself is less.
Well, that's what General Mattis said this morning, the Defence Minister of the US, that countries, typically over history, countries that don't set up alliances and keep them, wither and die, that to retreat is no answer.
There's no country can be an island unto itself or a world unto itself, not even the biggest country.
And how do you here in Singapore assess the threat of jihadism? I mean, Mindanao is much closer to you than it is to us. We've all had our experiences, but I wonder how you think this through.
We worry about extremist terrorism a lot. The Middle East seems a long way away, but it is not. And this is a problem which is amidst us. There are activists who have gone to the Middle East from Southeast Asia, from Malaysia, from Indonesia, a few from Singapore. There are activists who have gone to southern Philippines and are linked up with separatist groups there, including the Maute group, which is now in Marawi, and the Abu Sayyaf group. And it's a clear and present danger.
Do you let them back in? Are they allowed back in of any of your
citizens? Well, if we know of anybody who is there and he gets apprehended, we'll take him back, but we will take a very close look at him before we make sure that he is not brought back any dangerous ideas and is not likely to do any harm.
Because, I mean, you know, you've got this extraordinary balancing act that you've performed so brilliantly. I was just thought for Singapore, you know, if you look at Manchester, and it must be a worry.
No, you can never say that it will not happen. For us, we assume it's a matter of when and not whether. Because if you have a lone wolf or a single person mounting something and people don't know about it, it's very difficult to preempt and prevent. If you have a group, well, then there will be signs and somebody will chatter and then we may pick something up and we have a better chance of breaking it up beforehand. But even then, it's not certain. So we assume that one day something will happen in Singapore and we are doing our best to prepare ourselves so that if it does happen, we're psychologically prepared and our multiracial society will not be under catastrophic stress. Because a risk is not just the casualties from the physical attack, but the psychological damage you do to the trust and confidence between people of different races and religions in Singapore, and particularly between the Muslims and the non-Muslims.
I just want to go on to the economy now. You've got this marvellous accolade that you're the best place to set up a business in the world. 2.5 days to establish a business here. I think you're...
Well, you can actually register a company in a few minutes.
Okay, righto. Well, I think they meant this is the business of actually getting a little further than that. But your research and development, R&D, is now 2.1% of your GDP. It's 0.5% in Australia. It's 3% in Israel, which is generally regarded as the sort of exemplar. Do you worry that there are going to be jobs for ordinary Singaporeans, just like we worry in Australia, for ordinary Australians, if I can put it like that, in this future brave new world? Well,
there will be jobs. The question is what kind of jobs, and will it be able to use the talents and meet the aspirations of our people? And can we prepare our people for the jobs which we think they should be capable of doing? And that's a big challenge for everybody. I think because we are globalized and not just unto ourselves, so we can play a role which is servicing the region, which is servicing the world. And so I think we can have jobs in Singapore which are better paying for a wide range of our people.
You're putting a lot of money, aren't you, into the economy of the future and very concerned about how you position yourself. We sort of do it in Australia and then we pull back. We start and we stop.
It's not a matter of money. It's first of all, you must have the mindset that technology can make a big difference to us and we want to make full use of it. Secondly, you must have organizations which are geared up to be able to operate rationally and efficiently and in improved ways. When the technology comes, you're not just automating your old way of doing things. You may have to restructure altogether, and we must be prepared to do that. Thirdly, you must have the people who've got the ideas and the technical know-how to make the projects happen. And you must have a whole structure of managers, leaders, promoters, people who may not themselves be techies, but who have enough appreciation of technology, of what this is about, to know what is snake oil, what is real, what should be pushed, and which fears are genuine and which are just phantoms in the night.
So it's judgment, really.
You need that feel.
So these are systems you're talking about, whether your systems can, your whole of government systems.
It's the ethos of the society. Are you forward-looking? Are you prepared to change? Are you a society where if there's a problem, we can talk about it and we can begin fixing it? Or are there certain things which really not only can't be changed, but can't even be talked about?
Yes. So the no stop, don't. Stop it all, really.
Well, there really should be no wrong doors. Wherever you go, we'll find a way to make it happen. That's the ideal. We are some distance off from that.
You think that, do you?
I think so. I think there's a lot of work to be done. It's not easy to work this into our society. In a way, we have an advantage because our people are well-educated. Everybody has handphones and smartphones, and in fact, more than one per person. So the base is there. But to go from there to what the potential is and what we should be striving for, it's a lot of work.
Look, on a lighter note, I noted your exchange in Australia in 1967,
yes.
And that you've kept up with the people you lived with, and they were there last year. I just must ask you your observations about Australia over that time, and how, because you watch, I know Singapore watches Australia and probably frustrates Singapore quite a lot, but what do you see as Australia's main challenges?
Well, you have had to reorientate yourself from really Britain in the old days to now to Asia and to this part of the world, and to be wholly this part of the world. And I think your leaders are fully engaged in this. They fully understand this.
Your father called us to order on this quite a while ago in a very blunt way.
Well, he spoke his mind.
He certainly did.
I think in Western Australia it's quite clear. In the rest of Australia, I think your leaders know it. I'm not sure whether it's percolated all the way down into your society. With migration, it's easier because you've got the Asian population, so that gives you the family links. But I think many of your newspapers still may not be fully focused or fully sensitive to the nuances and the dynamics within the region. So you look at it as an outsider. You try to make sense of it as not really as an Asian. And I'm not sure that in that process, you're helping to make Australians understand Asia better.
That's what we try to do, I must say. And look, well, you must like this new Colombo plan. I think we've already got 80 students here from Australia.
You've had 1,000 students come on the plan.
1,000 already?
Of whom maybe 80 or so have come on scholarship. But the scheme itself, many have come and spent time here, and we're very happy.
And look, I finally have to ask you that I did notice that you felt that the previous Prime Minister, Tony Abbott, was a much better cooker of steak than you were, that your barbecue abilities weren't at their best when he was last here. So have you improved?
I try hard, but I think there's a long way to catch up.
You need more practice. Prime Minister, thank you very much indeed for giving us your time. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you.